This is the Rational Reminder Podcast, a weekly reality check on sensible investing and financial decision-making for Canadians. We're hosted by me, Benjamin Felix, and Cameron Passmore. All of his, or as much of his research as we reasonably could. We usually just go with the more recent stuff, which there's a ton of. I mean, he's published all sorts of papers in all sorts of journals, and it is just an absolutely fascinating body of work. It's focused on the psychology of long-term decision-making and how time affects people's lives. And it all ties back to this concept of well-being that, as everyone knows, we've been talking about quite a bit. In that field, in that subject matter, he's one of the world-leading experts, as far as I know. And the creativity to figure out what questions to ask and then design the studies to answer them, that's one of the things that jumped out at me as being just, how does he think of these things? It's unreal.
And then the results, back to how we prepare for these, I came up with, I think, 30 questions in a matter of an hour, just from kind of poking around his various papers. And I'm not even talking about in-depth reading. The questions just pour in. It was incredible research that has been done.
It's also, you know, just conceptually fascinating to think about the fact that his research isn't focused on finance, and it's not necessarily targeted at money, but finance and money inevitably become important parts of his research. Like, he's not setting out to be a finance researcher or a money specific researcher, but when you start thinking about long-term decision making, you cannot separate those things out. Yeah. So even though the papers aren't, some of them are actually specifically designed to ask questions about financial decision making, but anytime you start getting into this concept of long-term decision making, you just cannot separate out finance and money and their relationship with well-being. You can't. They're all part of the same resource pie.
So as I mentioned, he's an associate professor at UCLA Anderson School of Management. He has a PhD in psychology from Stanford and a BA in psychology from Tufts University. And we were lucky to reach Hal at his home in Santa Monica, California.
All right. It's a great conversation. Let's go ahead and play it.
Hal Hirschfield, welcome to the Rational Reminder Podcast.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
We're so excited to get to meet you. Your body of work is very impressive. So today's conversation is going to be a lot about well-being. So we thought we should kick this off with getting everyone on the same footing. Can you start by defining well-being?
Yeah, this is, I think, a great question. It's always important to start on the right foot. So, you know, well-being, of course, can apply in a general sense, right? So this can be more about how I'm feeling about my life. So we think about this as life satisfaction, and that's more of a 10,000 foot view. It's more cognitive in nature. You know, am I satisfied with the way things are going? Well-being can also encompass daily conceptions of this notion. So things like happiness. Am I experiencing more positive emotion than negative emotion? But well-being can also apply to financial well-being too. You know, in fact, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has done a lot of work looking at what they think of as financial well-being. Do I feel like I'm on top of my finances? Do I feel like I'm able to save? Do I feel like I'm able to sustain losses and also have some sort of short-term savings in case there's an emergency? I tend to think of these concepts as being related. You know, it's hard to have global well-being without also having financial well-being. I think that's the general idea there.
Now, you mentioned a few different components, I guess we could call them connected components of well-being. The answer to this question might be multifaceted, but how do you measure well-being?
Great. Okay. So it is multifaceted, right? So in other words, let's just say when it comes to life satisfaction, or I should probably step back and say some of these things are interconnected. It's possible to be satisfied with my life, but not necessarily always experience daily happiness, but these two things do sort of tend to travel together to some extent, but they can be separated. So often when we ask about life satisfaction, that component of well-being, this is something like you might tell somebody, you know, here's a picture of a ladder. There's a number of rungs. Tell me where you would place yourself on those rungs if you think of the ladder overall as representing your community. If you want a more lay definition of this is, you know, you go back to your high school reunion, where do I think I stand relative to everybody else? And so, you know, these are relative comparisons often. Happiness, on the other hand, there's questions that ask things like, yesterday, how happy were you on a scale of 1 to 7? Do you think of yourself as someone who's generally happy? Do you feel like you experience a lot of happiness? And by the way, I'll just caveat this and say, there's always pushback because you say, well, this is largely self-report, but people tend to know if they're happy or not, and their reports of whether they're happy or not seem to really matter for lots of outcomes like job satisfaction, marital satisfaction, health, depression, these sorts of things.
So you mentioned financial well-being. What are the financial behaviors that contribute to financial well-being?
Great. So these would be things like contributing to savings accounts, having a pool of emergency reserves in case there's, you know, an emergency expenditure that comes up, feeling like I'm on top of my finances, feeling like I can cover the next month's bill, but, you know, and also sort of related to that, feeling like my financial life isn't a roller coaster, but rather has some smoothness to it. I think financial well-being is not a situation where I'm having to scrape by every month and figure out how to pay the bills.
So those are behaviors. Are there any psychological determinants of financial well-being?
So I think this is a question that's really being explored a lot lately. We know that there's correlates of it, right? So we know that there's psychological aspects that are correlated or related to financial well-being. So, you know, for example, if I have a high propensity to plan, that's something that tends to be strongly related to financial well-being. In my own research, if I'm connected and I feel emotionally sort of identified with my future self, then I tend to do better when it comes to financial well-being. But, you know, Benjamin, the question you're asking about antecedents is a deep one, because, you know, to actually be able to pull that apart requires some really intense longitudinal research. You know, you'd almost want to track different kids and see what aspects are similar between them and what are different, and then predict who ends up with higher financial well-being. That's hard to do.
You mentioned something interesting just on the part of your research that looks at the closeness to future self and how that affects decision-making. One of your papers that I read had this fascinating idea of asking, so you mentioned that the closeness to future self can lead to better behaviors from a financial well-being perspective. Does that actually improve the well-being of your future self though?
That's a great question. Okay, so let me talk about it a couple of different ways. So when we look at some of this research where we try to examine how people's relationships with their future selves actually impact their decisions, I think you've kind of intuited that what we're looking at is their decisions right now, right? So if I feel connected to my future self, am I then likely to save now? Am I likely to sign up for a recurring deposit program? Am I likely to increase my contributions, et cetera? We're making an assumption that when I become my future self, and I recognize that's a vague statement, but when I get to a certain point in my life, we're making the assumption that if I've made sacrifices earlier in my life, I will be more satisfied with my life later on. But that is an assumption there, right? And so I want to be cautious not to say, I don't think the implication of this is that one should not enjoy anything in the present and always sacrifice so that, you know, I have all this money later on. But then what sort of memories do I have to look back on? You know, what sort of life is that, right? That's an extreme case, an extreme example. But, you know, I think of things like the FIRE movement, the financial independence retire early.
Yep.
And these folks in that community, from my perspective, they're almost living in such a strict and reduced way that I do question how much well-being they're experiencing in the present to get to that point later on. But I can also answer this one other way. There's a recent paper that my graduate student, Joey Reif, led, where we were able to actually get a data set, a longitudinal data set. These are people who are in their midlife, so between 40s, 50s, 60s. And in 1995, they were asked how satisfied they were with their lives. So this is one component of well-being. And they were also asked on a number of different dimensions to predict how similar they would be in 10 years. So how similar would they be on certain traits like being trustworthy and honest and these sorts of things? And then, you know, what was amazing is that these researchers actually followed up and got these people 10 years later and asked them 10 years later about how satisfied they were with their lives. And what was interesting was that the more similarity people perceive there to be between their 1995 selves and their 2005 selves. So just how much similarity did they think of when they thought of their future selves? That was a good predictor of how satisfied they would end up being 10 years later. Now, even when you control out, when you sort of statistically control for how satisfied they were with their lives earlier on. So if you took two people, and they were the same level of life satisfaction in 1995, but one felt more similar to his future self in 10 years, he would end up being more satisfied in 10 years. Now, Why does that happen? We can only conjecture. We think it's because they probably make decisions along the way to get themselves into a good place later on, but we can only conjecture at that at this stage. We weren't able to measure them along the way and say, what are you doing right now with your life?
Wow.
Wow. What can we do to get psychologically closer to our future self? Is there techniques?
Yeah, Cameron, I think this is a great question. And it's one that I and my colleagues and students have been grappling with for a long time now. You know, the way I tend to think of it is, I think we have to first start with the notion, and this is a philosophical notion, but I think it's a relevant one, that our future selves are in many ways like other people. We treat them in many ways like we treat other people. That's okay, right? But what really matters is what sort of other person that future self is. So if I can elaborate on that, we have all sorts of different relationships in our lives, and we treat these different people in our lives in different ways, right? So, you know, I treat my wife differently than I treat a new coworker at the office who I don't really know that well, right? And I'll probably make more sacrifices for my wife than I would for some guy at work. And so I think the same sort of concept is true for our future selves, that, you know, depending on how much we connect with them and how we relate to them, we're going to be doing different things for them. So the reason I bring this up is because I think it's suggestive of what sort of things we need to do to connect with those future selves. In other words, what sort of things do we need to do to connect with other people in our lives to make sure that we're taking care of them? So, you know, on the most basic level, one of those things is making sure that we can sort of vividly imagine our future selves so that we can empathize with them more. It's very hard to empathize with someone who is vague and distant in our mind's eye, right? You think about this with charity appeals, or, you know, not to get too heavy about it, but you think about this with, you know, the refugee crisis that's been happening in all parts of the world. You know, if you guys remember, this is pre-COVID time, so it feels like a very long time ago, but about two summers ago, we were getting reports all the time of tens of thousands of refugees who are getting on these boats and they're escaping, and many of them are dying, and it's horrible. And people took notice, but not as much notice as they took when there was one single photo that made the rounds all over the world of one small boy who tragically died on a beach. And again, not to get too heavy about it, but that was a vivid example. And boy, did that really change the conversation. Because it's hard to empathize with statistics, and it's easier to empathize with pictures and real people. I tend to think of this concept as being sort of reasonably applied to our future selves as well, which is, it's hard to empathize with them when they're just kind of an idea and they're vague. Mm-hmm. But when we try our best to make those future selves vivid, whether it's through writing to them, having a conversation with them, age progressing ourselves, you know, you can do this on Snapchat or FaceApp. There's a bunch of different, I think there's a couple different apps now that you can do this pretty well. I think that's a good first step to try to actually more realistically empathize and visualize our future selves.
Those are really interesting ideas. Writing a letter to your future self is fascinating. I know you did a paper on the age progression. We talked about that on this podcast in the past. When you say vividness, I imagining my future self. Is that a useful exercise, like just sitting and thinking about?
Well, I think it's as useful of an exercise as you can make it, right? So in other words, if you said to me, is it useful for me to exercise? Well, I'd say, sure, but, you know, what do we mean by you exercising, right? You know, so if your version of exercising is 10 pushups a day, I don't know if that's going to get you the results you want, depending on what your goal is, right? So if you tell me, I'm going to sit and think about my future self, but you do it for 10 seconds, and then you go about doing whatever else you're going to do, that may not be that that useful, right? So, but I do think if you do it in, I'm going to sound Californian when I say this, but if you do it in an intentional way, in a thoughtful way, then I think it actually could have an impact. You know, similarly, the idea of writing a letter, right? You know, there's a website, Dear Future Me, and they have seen, I think, a fivefold increase in the number of people who write emails to their future self since COVID started. I think a lot of people want to know what life will be like on the other side, and they want to reassure themselves on the other side. And that particular site, you write an email and it gets delivered to you at a specified future date. I love the idea because I think it forces people to actually think about who they'll be and who they want to be in the future in some realistic way.
Is it the act of writing the letter? Because I'm just thinking in that example of that service you were talking about, if you write the letter and then don't see it for however many years, is that the useful part? Or would writing it and then seeing it often be more useful or as useful?
Oh, that's a great question. I can only guess at this because, truth be told, we haven't tested what's doing the heavy lifting there. So, you know, my first guess would be that writing the letter itself would be a big step toward enhancing the relationship we have with our future self, because I think it forces you to think deeply about that future self. You know, I think so much of the problem when we talk about these future self, current self relationships is that the future self is sort of impoverished. We don't really put a lot of weight on it. We don't really consider it. We don't think about it in a meaningful way. But, you know, I think it's probably akin to a young couple talking about what their kids will be like before they've actually had kids. It's really impossible to really, really think about it, those kids, deeply without them existing. And of course, the future self doesn't really exist, but we can do exercises in our mind's eye to conjure it up and create it and construct it. So I would imagine that the writing of that letter helps. Now, I would say receiving that letter probably helps, but for a variety of other reasons. And this is something that I'm fascinated by, and we're starting to touch on and explore. In fact, this is separate from me. There's a eighth grade social sciences teacher in New Jersey who had his, or I'm sorry, sixth grade. He had his sixth graders, he's been doing this for 25 years now. He'd have his sixth graders write letters to their senior year selves. So that is their selves in 12th grade. What would that be? About 6 years later. He puts them in his closet and then he mails them out to them. And he's been recently sort of recording their reactions as they open up these letters. Mm-hmm. And it's wild because I think to some extent, these young or adolescents all of a sudden feel a connection to their past selves, which I think they can actually project forward and use to connect to their future selves. That's, again, just conjecture on my part, you know? So I think it could be useful in that regard. Now, that's a pretty extreme example. 6 years is a long time to wait. You got to have somebody mail those letters to you. He's got a stack that haven't been delivered because those kids have moved. But some of those kids are now like in their 30s and he still hasn't reached them. So I'd love to see their reaction when they get those.
Unreal. Now we've jumped into this conversation about past or present and future self, and I guess past self just now, which is fascinating conceptually. When does the present end and the future begin?
Yeah. Oh, I love this question. Yeah. So my University of Toronto collaborator, fellow Canadian, Sam Malio, he and I have been talking about this and asking this question. In fact, the amount of time it took us to ask and try to answer this question, I think we had three kids between the two of us, but it was the present ended and started again. We decided to ask this question of, generally speaking, when do people think that the present ends and gives way to the future? Now, I want to sort of make a note here, which is that I think there's a lot of different event-specific ways to answer this question. So the present could end when we finish this interview. The present could end when I get a vaccine, when you get a vaccine. But we were less interested in that because I think there's a lot of idiosyncrasies around, you know, specific events, and I'm not sure what that maps onto. We were more interested in people's general conceptions of when they thought the present, sort of this just concept of the present, what is it? When they thought that ends and rolls over to the future, you know, recognizing that this is happening sort of repeatedly. This is an ever-occurring experience. And we wanted to know whether or not perceptions of when that present ends mapped on to some sort of decisions that people make. Now, I think one of the most interesting things is when we did sort of qualitative research, just asking people what they thought about. And there are lots of people who said the present ends now, 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 now. It's constantly ticking over. And there were some people who said, well, about 5 minutes a day, maybe. There were some people who said, you know, the present ends when I die. This was a small portion of people. It was a, you know, sort of egocentric view of the present. It's all about me. But I think one of the most interesting things we found was it probably matters less objectively when, you know, the present ends. There's actually some hardcore cognitive psych research suggesting that the present in our mind is about 3 seconds. Well, okay, what do we do with that? I think what's actually more relevant is that it turns out that subjectively speaking, if people feel that the present ends sooner and the future starts sooner, those folks are more likely to make future-oriented choices and decisions. And I think it's a pretty straightforward thought, which is the idea that if I think the future is closer, or rather it starts closer, then I'm going to have to do something right now to make sure that self who's on the other side of that divide is going to be taken care of. And I fully recognize this is a pretty abstract concept and conversation. But practically speaking, we think these insights can be useful to change interventions and messaging. You know, we actually worked with a group on campus at UCLA and put out messages and ask people, we've sort of just said to them, the present ends soon, the future starts sooner. And we asked them if they wanted to sign up for a financial well-being course. Or we changed it and we said, you know, the present lasts for a long time, the future starts out here, but you know, maybe you should still enroll in a financial well-being course. And we had more people enroll in the course when the present ended sooner. And I would say, look, I think this needs to be further tested in the field with bigger populations, but anytime we can get any sort of message, if it's cheap, to move the needle on behavior is a win in my book, because structural changes are expensive, but messaging changes are cheap. And if they change behavior for the better, that's a great thing.
How does the perception of where that future self and present self, where that point is, does it matter where that point is on their well-being levels?
That's a great question. You know, Cameron, I don't think you guys should do the research. I would love it if we did this together. You know, I don't think, to the best of my knowledge, we have data to answer that question. Now, I'll say this. So, you know, there's two sort of related concepts here. The work that we did on when the present ends and the future begins, we made sure that it was really about the present in general and the future in general, not about present and future selves. I think that we're going to talk about much longer spans of time when I say, when does my present self turn into my future self? And by the way, I'm curious what you guys would say about that. And actually, with Professor Malio and a student, Elizabeth O'Brien, we've been asking this question to people. We've just started asking this question to people. That is, when do you think you become your future self? I mean, we're just starting to dig into this. We've been trying to map this on to behaviors like saving and smoking and drinking and do I wear my seatbelt and grades in high school? But we haven't added in these sort of well-being ideas. And I think it's a great question. I love thinking about this because I'm not sure when my future self starts or if it's already started. You know, I think there's probably some people who think, well, I've become my future self. That's me now. Or if I'm like, that's always some point in the distance, you know, and maybe you reach a certain age where you say, well, now I think I am kind of that guy. Things are sort of moving along. Or you say, no, in about 5 years, in 10 years, when the kids go to college, maybe that's when I'll become my future self. I don't know.
That always changes too.
I bet it does. Yeah.
For me, I guess I'm saying it's a bit of a moving target.
Yeah.
Is it possible, and would it be beneficial from a decision-making perspective to remove or help people remove that distinction between their present and future selves?
You know, I used to think yes. So I used to think that it was what we want to do is get people to think that their present and future selves are the same and that there's no difference there. I've really come to believe that that's actually not the right way we want to do this for two reasons. One, I think naturally people think of their future selves as if they're other people. And so why fight that? And two, let me just make an analogy here. If you're a smoker and I'm trying to get you to stop smoking and I tell you it's bad for your health, okay, fine. Might still be hard to quit smoking. But let's say you're a smoker and you're trying to quit smoking and I say to you, you know, that's bad for the people who you live with. It's going to affect them. Anecdotally, I think that that latter message is going to work better. I think we feel like, yeah, I know I'm messing up, but it's just me. But if I tell you, you've got a duty and a responsibility for someone else's well-being, I think that may matter. And so I think actually, it's not a bad thing to keep that distinction between present and future selves, to the extent that people may feel a sense of responsibility and duty toward those future selves. Those distinct future selves.
That is so interesting to think about.
Yeah. I mean, I think all this stuff is, you got to think about what the goal is, right? And so
I want to jump to a question about time.
Yeah.
So a lot of people these days say they just don't have enough time. We all hear that all the time. So is having too little free time detrimental to life satisfaction?
This is a great question. Recently, I have a working paper with Cassie McGillner-Holmes and Marissa Sharif, two colleagues. And we've been looking at essentially what is the relationship between the amount of time we have and our well-being, how satisfied we are with our lives. And you know, I think your intuition is right, Cameron. So if we have too little discretionary time, that does take a hit. That does cause a hit to our life satisfaction. By the way, there's a subjective nature to this, right? So I have to tell you, how much discretionary time do I have? By the way, when I say discretionary time, I don't mean, you know, take 24 hours in the day and subtract out the number of hours you worked. Because of course, there's lots of other things we're doing that aren't discretionary. You know, if you have kids, you might be taking care of them. If you have sort of other obligations, we're talking about the time that you have left in the day that you feel like you can kind of do what you want with that time. It may be pretty small for a lot of people. But, you know, we've actually looked at this both subjectively. That is, what reports do people say about their discretionary time? But we've also looked at this more objectively, in so much as we got data from what's called the American Time Use Survey. This is an incredible data set where people are asked to tell an interviewer every single minute of the day what they did the day before. And so they get these incredibly detailed reports where you can categorize. And I mean, you would crack up if you saw the categories of this thing. You know, it's taking care of kids' obligation, taking care of kids' fun, you know, throwing a ball, brushing hair, you know, like really minute stuff. And then we've come up with a way to sort of say, what of all of these categories counts as discretionary time versus everything else? And so then we can sort of more objectively say, how much of discretionary time does someone have? And it turns out that there's what we call a U-shaped relationship. So not enough discretionary time takes a toll on our life satisfaction and our overall well-being, but actually too much discretionary time seems to also have an impact on our well-being as well. Unless we feel like we are being productive in that discretionary time, then having more seems to have a positive impact on well-being, right? So I think there's something that's intuitive about that, but to sort of measure it, and I'm sure this is something that resonates with a lot of people, especially in COVID, you know, and I think we've all heard reports about the person who, Taylor Swift, coming up with however many new albums. Well, she seems like she's been productive with her discretionary time. And then there's the rest of us who feel like, I don't really feel like I got as much done as I was hoping to. So, you know, lots of people, to your original point, Cameron, say they want more time and they don't feel like they have enough. But it's not always the case that more and more and more time is going to be equal to more and more and more well-being.
Interesting.
Yeah, that is really interesting. It's about how you're using, given sufficient discretionary time, how you're using that discretionary time is more closely linked with well-being than just having the time.
And I would say that insight is similarly true of the other most important resource in our life, which is money, right? So, you know, I think there's debate all over the place about, you know, what's the right amount of money to have and what's the relationship between money and happiness and life satisfaction. But I do think one of the strong conclusions is that, you know, what matters is how we spend it. And I think the same is true for time. You know, it's not the amount that we have, but what matters is how we spend it and how we're able to spend it. And of course, this is to some extent coming from a privileged place. There's people who say, yeah, I'd love more discretionary time, but I don't have it. I have to work more jobs. I have to get more money. And unfortunately, that's where we look at that sort of lower end of the spectrum in terms of discretionary time, not having that much because I'm spending it working. Now, that could be true of an executive who's working 75 hours a week. And it could be true of somebody who's just at the poverty line, who's also working that many hours a week to try to scrape by, unfortunately, right? But in both cases, there's a time crunch.
You're edging into one of the other questions I want to ask, which is, given the choice, do people prefer to have more time or more money?
We asked this to actually to thousands of people, Cassie McGillner-Holmes and I, my colleague here, and a student, Yuri Barnia. And actually, by the way, I should say, we asked this question to thousands of people. And there was another group, Liz Dunn at University of British Columbia, and Ashley Willens, who was there as well, but she's now at Harvard Business School, also asked the same question. We were doing the same time. And we came to similar conclusions, which is that the majority of people say they want more money than more time. It's not terribly surprising. About two-thirds in our studies, I don't know what the numbers were for theirs, prefer money over time. It's a funny question. Like if I were to just approach you on the street and say, hey, you know, Benjamin, would you rather have more time or more money? Well, okay, am I given the choice? Is there a genie in a lamp? What else are they giving me? But I think what's less important is the reality of the question and more the diagnosticity of the question. That is, you know, what's a diagnostic of? And it turns out that the people who say that they want more time rather than money tend to be the ones who are happier. And now I just want to be clear, that's when we've set the stage to be equal in terms of baseline levels of income, education, gender, age. In other words, it could just be that the people who have more money and more education and who are older are the ones who want more time because they already have the money that they need. But, you know, as researchers, we want to sort of control for that statistically and keep people on the same playing field and then see how diagnostic is. And then in fact, you know, experimentally, we asked people to think about, well, what would it be like to have more time? We tried to get them to want more time. And we had another group and we asked them, what would it be like to want more money? Think about wanting more money. And the immediate impact of those exercises is that the people who write about wanting more time tended to be happier afterwards. And I think part of the reason is that they start thinking about how to spend that time in ways that could be productive. And when I say productive, that could mean, you know, I go to the wood shop and build something, but it could also mean productive. I'm going to call up a buddy I haven't talked to in 6 months. I'm going to spend some more time with my family. These are productive uses of time too.
That was fascinating data that you were just talking about. So controlling for financial circumstances, people that want more money are less happy. Is that right?
That's right. That's right. Also controlling for, you know, we could look at things like what we call, you know, like a materialism scale. You know, so it could be the case that you control for all these things, but somebody who puts more value in the type of car I have and the type of handbag I own and the clothes I have, well, maybe those are the folks who want more money, and maybe, you know, materialism isn't necessarily the best route to happiness. But even then, you know, we ask people about their materialistic preferences. And even when you control for that, we still see the same findings there as well.
What do you think about just on this topic, in addition to having this podcast, Cameron and I have a wealth management business where we have a bunch of clients who we give financial advice to. How do you think someone in our position, or even more broadly speaking, someone who's leading the household finances, what kind of conversations do you think we can be having to help people make the right decisions in terms of what's going to lead them toward more well-being?
Well, first off, let me just commend you by saying that last part is what's so important, because I always think it's important to say, what do we mean by the right decisions, right? Because, you know, my right decision, you know, maybe my right decision is I need to have an 80% replacement ratio in order to feel satisfied in retirement. I don't know how I came up with that, but somehow I did. But someone else is going to say, no, I don't need all that money in retirement. So what's most important is, can we first identify what's the right metric so that we can say, okay, well, what is a given person? What do I need? What does somebody else need? Some of this stuff we can't know, right? And I want to come back to that in a second. But I would say that one of the most important things that we can do here is to think a little bit more deeply about who we think will be in the future, who we want to be in the future, and what that future life will look like. And I mean that from the standpoint of, what will we be doing? Where will we be living? How much time do I want to have and do I need to have? These are really hard questions to answer. And I'm not suggesting that people are going to have the answers to them. But I think one of the problems that I've observed anecdotally in the sort of financial advisory and financial decision-making space is that people set goals for the future. And we know this is such a common practice in the wealth management business. Let's see, what goal do you have? You know, when do you want to retire? How much money do you want to have? How many trips do you want to go on? But they set those goals before they really think about what life will look like and who they want to be from a more sort of holistic standpoint. And my question is, how meaningful are those goals if you've come up with them before you really had that conversation with your future self or with your future selves? You know, especially I think a lot of these decisions are joint decisions, family decisions. What does life look like on the other side for my whole family? That's one of the first pieces of advice I would give, was to have that conversation, think about that self, and think about all these other aspects of time and the trade-offs we want to have. Now, the second thing I would say is, I guess it would be, have some self-compassion, have some respect for the idea that preferences can change over time. And, you know, I'm fond of quoting this, or rather referencing this sort of thought experiment that a philosopher named Laurie Paul came up with. And she's a philosophy professor at Yale. And she talks about the, she calls it the vampire problem. And it goes something like this, where she says, you know, imagine all your friends are becoming vampires and they tell you that you too should become a vampire. And you don't really know what it's going to be like, but they say, look, you like to stay up late. Check, you know, you like to wear black. So good. That's another plus. Maybe you have sort of a predilection for novel foods. Okay, this is good. But you can't really know what it's like to become a vampire until you actually decide to pull the trigger and become a vampire. But here's the catch. Once you become a vampire, you can't undo it. You are now a vampire. And the big thing is that once you become a vampire, your preferences might change. You might become a slightly different version of you because now you're a vampire. And can we fully anticipate that? And her argument is that no, we can't. And we have to be okay with that. Now, by the way, this is an analogy, right? It's an analogy for becoming a parent. It's probably an analogy for other things too, but she most directly likens it to the process of becoming a parent, which is that I can think about what it might be like, but it's only once I actually have kids that I now know what it's like, and my preferences might change in irrevocable ways. One conclusion from this is that life is inherently unknowable and unpredictable, and this could be terrifying. I actually take a more positive conclusion from this, which is that we have to be okay with the idea that preferences might change. I might save up because I think in retirement I'm going to be traveling the world and traipsing all over the place. But I could also reach retirement and be older and value sort of more ordinary experiences, and actually would put a lot of value in spending time at home with my kids and my grandkids and this sort of thing. I don't know. And if those changes happen, so be it. But I think one of the considerations we have to make, again, you know, coming back to your question, is we can only go so far in trying to predict what our life will be like, but we have to also respect our future selves enough to recognize that their preferences and decisions might change. And can we account for that in our decisions that we're making right now? Maybe it means giving ourselves some more option value.
This is so interesting. It makes me think of the paper you co-wrote about, you know, approaching new decades in your chronological age. So we have very dear clients that did exactly that. In our 50s, we're going to have this lifestyle in the house. In our 60s, we're going to travel much more. In our 70s, we're going to sell our house and downsize and have a place in the South. So they viewed all these different decades deliberately on the decade, like on the zeros. Can you talk about how changes in the chronological age trigger some sort of special reflection? And does that help in viewing your future self by having this potentially predictable future vision?
Yeah, I love that those are the conversations that you've had. And of course, in a way, I'm not surprised that clients have these conversations and thoughts. I mean, I think one of the amusing things about these conversations is, as we all know, turning a new decade from one day to the next doesn't really change anything, right? You know, going from 29 to 30, going from 39 to 40, it's not like, well, actually, one of my best friends, when he turned 40, literally that day, his back gave out. So I think for him, he saw a real, real qualitative change. Ouch. But literally, but I think for most people, obviously, time is continuous, change is gradual, and the ticking over from one year to the next, to some extent, is arbitrary, right? You know, this is based on calendar years. And our sort of special focus on these milestone birthdays, I think, is a consequence of our numbering system and the fact, you know, that we have a base 10 system, right? And so it's funny in a way, right? Because why should it matter that now I'm 50, now I'm 60? But it does. And I think what happens is that milestone birthdays and these decade markers provide an external reminder for us to stop and reflect, in the same way that a new year provides a reminder for us. It's an external force that makes us kind of pause and stop. And there's nothing to say that you couldn't decide to do this when you're 45 and a half. But people don't do that because life takes over and the present is all consuming and you're busy, but oh, I'm about to turn 50.
Yeah.
This is a good time to stop and reflect, right? And so actually one of my best friends and collaborators, Adam Alter, we looked at this question and we did find that when people turn these milestone birthdays, or rather when they were at a 9 ending age, that is before the milestone birthdays, they were more likely to be searching for meaning in their lives. That's a small effect, I'll say. You know, this is something we did. We looked at tens of thousands of people with what's called the World Values Survey. It looks at all these people around the world and asks questions like, are you searching for meaning? And I'll note, it's not surprising that it's a small effect. Think about how many different factors are impacting our search for meaning in our lives, right? I'd be surprised if it was a big effect, but it's there. And I think it's suggestive of the idea that we are reflecting on our lives when we're about to turn these milestone birthdays. And by the way, we've seen this experimentally, and we see other research groups have sort of converged on these findings as well. I actually think what's maybe more interesting is what happens as a function of that taking stock or that reflection. And I think, you know, your intuition, your guys' intuition, that this is a good time to try to make some changes. It's a good time to think about like how we want our life to be is right on, because even though it's arbitrary, that is the ticking over of the decade is arbitrary, why not tie that to decisions that could change our course in some ways for the better? You know, what we found in our data was, you know, we looked at a lot of different behaviors and we noticed that people sort of engage in these sort of funny behaviors around these milestone birthdays. And when I say funny behaviors, I mean behaviors that we think of as meaning-seeking behaviors. So for example, we found an uptick in the number of people who signed up for their first marathon right before they turned a milestone birthday. I think that one resonates. It's like I turned 40 a year and a half ago. And I remember around that time, a lot of my friends from high school, seeing them post things on social media about, you know, I'm going to undertake this thing this year. Anybody want to join me? You know, I got to do it before I turn 40, this sort of thing, right? And we also unfortunately saw some evidence for the darker side of this too. You know, in other words, you can imagine that the process of taking stock of your life could result in, you know, a more positive impression. All right, there's other things I want to accomplish. I'm going to try to accomplish them. It could also be psychologically difficult, you know, where I say, look, these are the things I want to do and I'm falling short and it may cause one to withdraw. There's a theorist named Roy Baumeister who's talked about this idea. And, you know, we saw evidence for this. We got access to a large data set from Ashley Madison, the dating site for people who want to have extramarital relationships. We actually saw that there was a slight uptick in the number of people on that site whose ages were, you know, just before those milestone birthdays. Now, there's some question marks there, right? If they're going to have a go on Ashley Madison, are they reporting their right age? And we sort of did some analyses to see if there's any evidence of systematic lying. And we didn't necessarily see that, but there's been some other sort of not peer-reviewed, but other reports suggesting similar things. But, you know, we also saw this, we looked at suicide rates for a 10-year period, and we saw very, very slight upticks around these milestones as well. I'm not saying this has to be dark or it has to always be this way, but I do think that these milestone birthdays, which I conceptually think of as a time when people sort of turn over from one present self to a future self, I think of them as being times when people naturally do take stock. And on the one hand, and on the other hand, I think of them as times when we might be able to have that extra bit of motivation to make some change.
Fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
Shifting gears a little bit, for retirees, are there differences psychologically? And I mean, we kind of know this totally, I guess, but are there differences in the way that a retiree perceives a financially equivalent lump sum versus a monthly income stream?
Right. So in some work with Dan Goldstein and Shlomo Ben-Artzi, we were trying to look at what happens when people are, if you want to kind of tie this in, you know, what happens as people are looking ahead to a future self, especially as they're looking ahead to the retirement years. They're near that stage of retirement and they're faced with a decision, which is, you know, do I cash out my savings and try to invest it? Do I roll it over into an annuity so I can have some guaranteed lifetime income and or some sort of middle of the road option? Now, one of the things that we found, actually, one of the things that my colleague Shlomo Ben-Artzi noticed, he was on a call with a financial advisory call center, and an employee called in and said, well, I think I want to lower my savings rate. And the call center employee said, okay, well, how come? Let me just ask you why. And the employee said, well, you know, I've got a lot saved up for retirement. This was like probably 40-something, I think. I'm not positive. And the call center employee said, well, let's see. Ah, yes, I see you've got $50,000 saved up. That is a lot of money. And of course, $50,000 is a lot of money. It's not enough if you want to retire at a reasonably young age and possibly have that fund you for 15 to 30 years of retirement, right? But the sort of catch here was that when you think about that lump sum, the lump sum may feel psychologically bigger or more adequate then if you were to do the math and convert it into some annuitized stream. And I think this kind of harkens back to something we were talking about earlier, which is the idea of vividness. You know, we can think about our future selves in abstract ways, or we can think about them in vivid ways. The same is true for money. We can think about some amount of money in the future as an abstract concept, you know, $50,000, $100,000, undoubtedly a lot of money and more money than most people are used to dealing with in a single setting, a save for maybe a down payment on a home. And even then, we rarely do this. But when you turn that into a more vivid representation, that is, you turn it into an annuitized stream, then I think people have an easier time understanding it because I know what my monthly expenses are, roughly speaking. I know what my rent check is or my mortgage check. I know what my car payment is. I have a sense, roughly speaking, what my credit card payment is. So if you were to say to me, these savings equate to about $1,000 a month, I could pretty quickly tell you, ooh, that's not going to cut it, you know? And so that becomes more vivid.
So given what we know about, you know, annuities being beneficial, do you have any suggestions in terms of how the decision to annuitize could be framed to get people to be more vivid, to use your word, about going the annuity route?
I do think one thing that we have to think about is just what we were talking about there, which is how much money do you actually need month by month in retirement? And, you know, this to me is where financial advisors and wealth managers really come into play, because it's helpful to help people make that translation. What are your savings going to amount to? What do you actually need? And, you know, of course, where's the shortfall? However, you know, where the shortfall is, that's a tough one to go, because I think people see that. They say, oh, I'm about $1,000 short. I'm about $2,000 short. And then those optimism biases kick in and they say, I'll figure out how to make it up. I'll be able to handle this. So that may not be the best route, right? But expressing vividly what amount you'll have and what you might need, I think could be helpful. Now, the power of annuities in my mind is that it forces people to recognize that they may outlive their savings, and that here's a product that could help sort of bridge that gap. Now, it's not a perfect product for everybody, right? If I'm relatively wealthy, I can almost sort of self-annuitize, right? Self-insure against outliving my money. If I'm on the lower end of the spectrum and there's Social Security that's going to essentially create 100% replacement ratio, I don't know that it makes sense to turn what little savings I have into an annuity and lock it up that way. But for the, you know, sort of the middle swath, I think this can be a product that's really beneficial. I'm not saying everyone has to fully annuitize, but even some partially so could provide a lot of security. My colleague Craig Fox and I have done a lot of thinking about this, because the way an annuity is framed also matters. You know, if I tell you this is an investment product, it doesn't look so great. But if I talk about it as a product that is essentially going to give me some spending power, I put it in terms of spending rather than investing, then it starts to look a lot better. And there's some research suggesting just that. Because, you know, I could probably get a better return, especially if I look at recent trends, right? So, you know, one of the things we know is that recent trends in the market seem to have an undue influence on people's decisions to annuitize or cash out. If I see that the market's been steadily increasing, there's actually a fascinating paper on this, not my research, but a guy named Alessandro Privitaro. If I see the market's been relatively stable and steadily increasing, I tend to think it's going to keep going that way forever, and I'd be better off cashing out, you know? But if I see volatility, if I see drops, if I see sort of possible uncertainty, then the tendency is to want to purchase an annuity rather than cash out.
Yeah, the annuity psychology is just fascinating.
I also find it fascinating because it also, by the way, pushes up against something no one wants to think about, which is death. You can have a conversation about annuities without explicitly bringing up death, but there's pretty much no way to do it without implying it, because the first calculation I have to make is the hardest one, which is how long do I think I'm going to live for? And by the way, just that question alone, the way you frame that question, if I ask you how long do you think you'll live until, you'll give me a different answer than if I ask you when do you think you'll die by. On the magnitude of about 10 years.
Wow.
It causes people to think about different things. When will I die by? Well, I think about my uncle who died a little early. I think about this guy I know died a little early. When will I live until now? I think of my grandmother's living a nice long life. And there's possibilities there. So the anchor is different things. That's work by Suzanne Hsu at Cornell University.
Wow. That's so interesting. It's crazy.
Yeah, it's a really subtle thing, you know, but it matters.
Unreal. When you dig into the annuity stuff, there are some interesting papers out there and practitioner research too, I guess, showing that there is a sort of statistically optimal allocation to annuities for that middle bracket that you were talking about. But even then, even if we can tell someone this is statistically optimal for you to do, the framing in the conversation is so important. It's not enough just to say, look, this is optimal.
Statistically optimal is the type of thing that appeals to academics who study financial decision making and financial advisors and wealth managers, but it's not the thing that I find resonates with everyday people living their lives, you know, because what matters is what's emotionally optimal.
Right.
And by the way, you know, statistics operate on averages, and nobody likes to think of themselves as an average necessarily.
Right. We touched earlier on how people spend their money being more closely linked to well-being than how much money that they have. You've got a recent paper that talks about the relationship between meaning and spending, or what meaning people ascribe to the act of spending. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. And I just want to say, you know, Heather Barry Kappas, who's a professor at London School of Economics. She's the real spearhead on this project. And she actually had this observation. I think it was a funny observation. It really made me sort of scratch my head when she first brought it up, which was that when people look around at others, they look around at their neighbors or the people in their lives. Is it possible that we attribute spending to wealth? In other words, the people who spend a lot may be wealthier. Now, the irony, of course, is that the more I spend, the less money I have. Now, she actually took this observation actually from, you know, you look at some people in this FIRE movement, right? Somebody says, I have the plainest house on my street, but what my neighbors don't know is that I probably have the biggest bank account because I haven't been spending. So one of the things that we looked at in this paper, this is also alongside Joe Gladstone, who's at University of Colorado, was how do these perceptions of what other people spend, or rather, how do my perceptions of other people's spending and wealth relationships matter for my own financial well-being? And it turns out that if I think that spending implies wealth, I'm actually going to be more financially vulnerable. We actually, you know, Joe had access to a data set of real consumer transactions. And we were able to survey these people and ask them, to what extent do you think that spending implies wealth? And I'm sort of paraphrasing the questions that we used. And again, you know, it's important to statistically control for lots of other things here, which we did. And it turns out, even setting aside all these other factors that you think would matter, to the extent that I think spending implies wealth is indicative of me being more financially vulnerable and me spending in more conspicuous ways and me having lowered financial well-being. So, you know, I think it does raise some really interesting policy questions, and it raises interesting questions regarding, you know, well, how do you change these beliefs? I think to some extent, just stopping to think about it for a second matters. You know, I think most people have knee-jerk responses. Then you start really doing the math and you say, wait, if they bought this, 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 and this, they can't have that much wealth. And then, by the way, this boils down to another question, which is, well, what does matter? How much money do I need? How do I want to spend that money for my well-being overall?
Is that nature or nurture?
You know, I think like many other psychological concepts, it's got to be some blend of both.
Do people change over time, or do they reflect their upbringing and how they spend?
I think that they do to some extent reflect their upbringing. But I think that change in this space may be hard because, you know, we get kind of set in our patterns and our ways, right? And so to make a change, this kind of harkens back to our earlier conversation, which is that to make a change, we really have to find the right incentives and the right sort of motivation, the right impetus to do that. And so maybe that's the type of thing that can happen when we're having these life changes, like a new decade. Or so maybe this is the type of thing that can happen when we have some new family change or some sort of external motivation to make a change.
So interesting. So our final question for you, Hal, which we always ask, looking forward to your answer on this one. How do you define success in your life?
Such a great question. I've been thinking about this a lot lately. How do you define success? I mean, I think there's external markers of it. So you can look at how you progress through your career and you can look at your bank account. And those are easy and quantifiable metrics, right? But I think more than that, it's having what you want. I would also add, and it sounds a little cliche, wanting what you have. And I also think lately I've been noticing that I think success means having the time and resources to be able to spend my time the way that I want to. I think about that, especially with regards to family and especially with regards to being able to be present when I'm spending that time. You know, I think for me personally, there's been times where objectively speaking, things could look successful, but I'm stressed out, worried, or so focused on the next thing that I have a hard time being here right now. And if there's one upshot to COVID, it's, you know, forced us to spend a lot more time at home with the kids and see sort of how quickly they've been moving through life. I guess, you know, I would hate to look back and say, I missed a lot of that because I was focused on something else. And so I think to be successful means being able to be present there. I think it's also the type of thing that you can always improve on, or at least I can.
That's a unique answer to the question. I don't think anybody's ever told us that the ability to be present is a definition of success. That's a really, really good one.
Thanks. Well, you should check in with my wife and kids and see how I'm doing on that.
Well, Hal, this has been an incredible time spent with you, an amazing collection of thoughts. I'm so happy to meet you. So thanks so much for your time.
Guys, I loved it. Thank you so much for having me on. I'm really honored to be included as one of your guests.